Palestinian terror organizations and the Palestinian propaganda machine have understood a long time ago that charities and NGOs are the easiest to abuse and use, but also it comes as part of a broader campaign of weaponizing human rights. It's huge, it's an industry, and a big part of that machinery has one goal, and that is to vilify the Jewish state and the mere legitimacy that we have one. It has nothing to do with which government is in power, what is the coalition. This is a matter of national security, and that cannot and must not be undermined, because it is an extremely, unfortunately, effective tool against us, one that we struggle in fighting much more than on a physical battlefield.
Welcome to Miskav Mideast Horizons. I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host, the executive director of the Miskav Institute for National Security, and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. My co-host, Lav Harkov, is on maternity leave. She gave birth to a beautiful baby daughter. And of course, we wish her all the best and mazal tov. On many podcasts, social media, various media platforms, we saw over the past week a lot of commentary regarding Nicholas Kristof's column in the New York Times, alleging that Israel carries out systematic sexual abuse of Palestinian prisoners, in most cases incarcerated Palestinian terrorists. And many people have done an excellent job analyzing his claims, which are physically or physiologically impossible, which are can be traced to Hamas-adjacent organizations, which are unverifiable and unsourced. And for those of us who have been following the attack, the delegitimization, the demonization of Israel, not only since October 7th, but really for decades, this was just perhaps one of the most egregious, but which is the latest example of a long line of claims, whether it's apartheid or genocide or systematic starvation, claims that really, if you just look at the facts, if you look at reality, have no basis, right? If the population is growing, then obviously a genocide is not being carried out. But the that are being hurled at Israel again and again, this time in the New York Times. Now, what not everybody is aware is that behind the expressions, these claims that end up in the op-ed pages or that end up on a podcast, is in fact a vast network, an often hidden network, what I think could be called the NGO industrial complex, or the NGO media, governmental, bureaucratic complex. And when I mean complex, we're talking about hundreds, perhaps thousands of organizations, generally non-governmental organizations. Some of them are small and local. Some of them are large international organizations. These organizations are funded by hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of dollars, often from European governments, from UN and other international institutions, in some cases indirectly from the United States, and of course from various progressive foundations and philanthropists. And these organizations work very, very closely with aligned media, with international organizations, government officials, bureaucrats, diplomats, to create this almost closed loop where the governments or the institutions pay the NGOs to create reports attacking Israel, demonizing Israel, alleging all kinds of misdeeds on the part of Israel. And then after paying for these reports to be created, those same diplomats or bureaucrats take these reports as proof that Israel is in fact deserving of condemnation, sanctions, boycotts, and using that to justify further steps against the world's only Jewish state. Now, this is a vast interconnected network with far-reaching implications, not just for Israel, but also for the United States, for Western civilization, for basic journalistic integrity, for the truth. And nobody has done a better job year after year for decades now exposing this network, exposing the way it works, exposing in often its corruption, its often ties to designated terror organizations. No one has done a better job than NGO Monitor, an organization founded by Professor Gerald Steinberg 25 years ago. Professor Steinberg has led the organization since its founding 25 years ago, and it was just announced very recently that there will be a leadership transition, and Olga Deutsch, the current vice president of NGO Monitor, will step into Gerald's very large shoes. Olga Deutsch also, we're very proud, is a fellow at the Miskov Institute for National Security. She previously served in numerous senior roles in both the public and private sector in Israel and Europe, including as a member of the executive of the World Zionist Organization and as a student, as the chair of the European Union of Jewish Students. This week, we speak to Olga in order to look at the man behind the mask or the network behind the mask and expose what is this network that has been for decades and even more intensively since October 7th, working to demonize, delegitimize, apply double standards to the state of Israel. And of course, we should acknowledge that in cases where there is valid or constructive criticism of the state of Israel, it is certainly incumbent upon Israel and its government and its leaders to take that criticism to heart and to act, to change, to improve, to correct, to punish misdeeds. There are many cases of that happening, but this network is not interested in improving the state of Israel. This network is interested in achieving the ultimate goal of weakening, undermining, silencing, and delegitimizing the Jewish state. Olga Deutsch talks with us this week to go in depth and to explain how this network works. And just before we go to Olga, we remind you to please follow, like, subscribe to Mideast Horizons wherever you get your podcast in order to stay ahead of the curve and to go beyond the noise and the headlines and the spin to really understand what is happening in Israel and the Middle East, and share this podcast with anybody who you think might be interested. You can reach out to us with comments, questions, suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we read all your comments. We use them in order to decide future guests and future topics, so please keep them coming. So without further ado, please stay tuned for this far-reaching conversation with Olga Deutsch. Olga Deutsch, it's a pleasure to have you on the Miskav Mideast Horizons podcast. Congratulations on your recent appointment as president of NGO Monitor after 25 years in which Professor Gerald Steinberg led the organization. And also, we're very happy to have you as a senior fellow here at the Miskav Institute. So it's great to have you on.
Well, thanks so much, Asher, for having me, and thank you for your nice thoughts. It is a huge shoes to fill and I'm humbled and at the same time very, very excited. And I'm also excited that I joined the Miskav team of experts and amazing leaders. And from the first moment I joined, it has been an incredible experience. And I feel privileged to be able to contribute through two such incredible platforms, working on issues that I believe are some of the most existential and most important issues for the Jewish people and for the state of Israel today.
So it's fantastic to have you. And many of our viewers and many of our listeners will be familiar with the anti-Israel, often anti-Semitic, often anti-Western campaign that against Israel that we've seen certainly since the Durban Conference of 2001, and even more so since October 7th. And occasionally there are examples that are just so egregious that it leads to a lot of discourse, a lot of backlash, like we saw with Nicholas Kristof's op-ed in the New York Times recently, or even now these sort of propaganda flotillas that are on their way from Turkish flotillas on the way from Europe to the Gaza Strip. But I think a lot of our viewers and listeners might not be fully aware of just the inner workings of this campaign and how massive it is. We're talking about billions of dollars and hundreds, maybe thousands of organizations and tight interconnected relations between NGO activists and media and government officials and officials in international institutions. So can we take a step back and maybe sort of pull the mask off? And can you share with our listeners a little bit about how this huge, global, well-funded anti-Israel network, what it looks like, what its chief components are, and how it works, and how it influences and impacts the way that Israel is seen in Israel's international standing and relations every day?
It's such a great question, and it's such a timely question, especially these past days. As you say, the Christoph opinion piece, right, lays down some of the great, like the gravest accusations, libelous accusations against Israel, and all the while using the words of well-documented, well-sourced, and so on. And then you have the flotilla, where it's the peace activists and human rights defenders boarding these vessels, and on at least on paper, they say they want to provide humanitarian aid. And then we just completed the Eurovision saga, right? When we also saw protests and demonstrations and campaigns and calls for boycott and so on and so on. And, you know, we can go back and trace this to Airbnb pulling out of or taking down some of their listings beyond the 67 line or the green line, you know, different situations where international artists are pushed not to come to Israel, sanctions against Israeli businesses, then all the way to the International Criminal Court in The Hague and International Court of Justice in Hague that are spearheading libelous claims, you know, accusing Israel of apartheid and genocide and issuing arrest warrants against Israeli officials and Israeli soldiers. If it's media reports that Israeli soldiers are being hunted down around the world when they go backpacking, whether it is in South Africa, Latin America, sorry, or in Europe, for allegedly committing crimes against humanity and violating international law for their services. All these have become our reality, especially, as you said, after October 7th and the Hamas massacre, when this incredible hatred was simply unleashed and sort of normalized, right? But what few people know is what is the common denominator between all these and many more tactics. And this is that all of them are spearheaded, led by so-called human rights and humanitarian NGOs, non-governmental organizations. Now, what happens is when you talk to counter-terror experts about a conflict anywhere else in the world, and you ask them, how do typical terror organizations operate? One of the first things they will say and write in literature about is that they clearly use charities, welfare organizations, sometimes mosques, right, to raise funds, share, you know, promote their sphere of interest and share it, recruit. They use them as conduits for financial support and so on. But somehow, only when it comes about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and Palestinian terror organizations, even most of the counter-terror experts around the world somehow cannot wrap their minds around a simple fact that Palestinian terror organizations and the Palestinian propaganda machine have understood a long time ago that charities and NGOs are the easiest to abuse and use, but also it comes as part of a broader campaign of weaponizing human rights, which is the language of the 20th and 21st century, right? Like, if there's anything that we have accomplished as a civilization after the Second World War, that is the rule of law, democracy, the protection of human rights. So these exact values are being weaponized and used against the Jewish people and the state of Israel to undermine the very legitimacy of our right to have a state and a Jewish homeland. And these organizations that define themselves as human rights or humanitarian organizations are somehow always at the forefront.
But this was what Gerald has called the halo effect, right? Where you can have any kind of organization. It can be a Hamas front organization. It could be an organization that is promoting violence. It's promoting terror. But once they put the word human rights into their name of their title, or, you know, humanitarian into their title, they had this halo effect where a lot of people, media, diplomats, politicians, assume that they must, well, if they have human rights in their title, then they must be driven by altruistic or noble values, which is, you know, again, no, anybody can, you know, any organization can put whatever it wants in its name. So you have this absurdity where an organization that's literally a Hamas front organization sticks human rights in its name, and all of a sudden it's treated like a legitimate and trustworthy body.
So it's exactly as you say, but I would say that in the last couple of years, it became even worse and more dramatic than that. Like, if in the beginning that was part of the, that's why they chose the approach, because by mere attaching the name human rights, they sort of earned this blind trust and almost an automatic inability by an average person, politician or not, or a journalist, to question, right? And to question their integrity, their sources or anything, or apply the same scrutiny that they would apply to any other policy area that they would report on or talk about. But in the last couple of years, it is not just the halo effect, but they literally have become the main vehicles of what I see is a campaign of normalizing and oftentimes romanticizing terror organizations and terrorists as a complementary tactics to physical warfare that is being waged against us. What do I mean by that? We see a campaign where even now, in, let's take Christoph's op-ed as the most, you know, recent example of this. Throughout the article, Christoph, Pulitzer Prize awarded journalist that has a stellar reputation for speaking up for the weak and the not protected, right, people, comes and throughout his over 3,000 words long op-ed, which is unheard of, he does not mention the word Palestinian terrorists even once. He calls them Palestinian prisoners. And then he says, and you know, Palestinian prisoners, particularly the ones coming from Gaza, are treated even worse than the ones coming from the other parts of the Palestinian territories. And when you repeat this over and over, Palestinian terrorists, then all of a sudden, no one reading the article says, well, what are they serving their sentence for? Because most of the Palestinian prisoners serving their sentences in Israeli prisons are there for terror attacks. And if they are from Gaza, then it begs an automatic question, at least to me, were they part of the October 7th massacre? Maybe, I don't know, right? Then you have a parallel thing. You have a BBC, right, reporting on what is going on in Gaza in the last 2.5 years. And then they refuse to call Hamas terrorists. They call them freedom fighters, militants, and there's a whole debate. Although Hamas is a designated terrorist group in the UK, and yet we have a leading broadcasting company that just relativizes it and poses a question. So it's part of a broader campaign where Hamas and other Palestinian terrorists are normalized and presented as, you know, just militants, almost as a legitimate army fighting against another legitimate army. And oftentimes it's even romanticized. And that cripples our ability to even resort to facts and figures that we have.
So it's clear why this NGO network should be something that concerns people who support Israel, who support Israel's right to exist. If I'm an American or a European and I don't have a particular connection to Israel, is there a reason why I should be concerned about this NGO industry that is shaping a lot of what's considered to be common knowledge about what's happening in this part of the world?
Absolutely. And there's a few reasons for that. First of all, these groups are not only attacking Israel. Their main goal, at least in terms of their narrative, is to undermine the right, like to promote anti-Zionism. They will also always say, we're not anti-Jewish, we're anti-Zionist. But at the end of the day, the fear-mongering and the spreading of violence and normalizing, calling for violence happens on the soil of the countries around the world and not in Israel, right? At the end of the day, these groups are active on U.S. campuses, on U.S. streets, Canadian streets, European streets. We have seen multiple occasions of terror attacks and violent attacks against Jews, but not only Jews. But it's more than that. These groups are calling at the same breath, death to U.S., death to Israel. Most of these groups will, in the same vein, basically say, you know, they oppose the Zionist entity and the Jews who control the world and all the anti-Semitic tropes, but also the entire Western, you know, world order and civilized world. They are working to undermine the systems as we know them in our respective societies. And I'm not prone to conspiracy theories or generalizations. I think these are very dangerous. And they're dangerous when they're applied against us, but they're also dangerous when we try to apply them lightly. So I'm not even going to talk about Islamist campaigns, but I am going to mention that a lot of these groups are anti-establishment and anti-government, and they're calling for, you know, dismantling of our systems as we know them. And none of that is healthy, and none of that is constructive. It is okay to be critical of any one government. It is okay to be in opposition, but it is entirely a different thing to call for taking down, you know, the whole system, or romanticizing terror groups. It, you know, we always say, it starts with the Jews, but it never ends with the Jews. And I think when there's such normalization of violence against Jews, both in rhetoric and physically, that says a lot about how healthy anyone's society is in general, in terms of liberties, democracy, of its entire population. And I think when the public discourse and the freedom of speech is so diminished, and when just because you think differently, you're being canceled right away, people should not think that it will bypass them and just stick with the Jews. And, you know, last but not least, it is a very dangerous discourse to say it is a matter of the Jewish community and the safety of the Jewish community and those who care about Israel. We have spent a greater part of post-World War time arguing and fighting for it and defending the fact that a French Jew is as French as a French Christian or a French, you know, atheist, or a French Muslim, and the same goes for the U.S. or any other country in the world. At the end of the day, it is the responsibility of these governments to protect their citizens, whether they're Jewish or not, right? And we see that no one else is being attacked in a similar way over no other minority, right? Ethnic or religious, over something that is happening thousands of kilometers away. So I do think it is very, very dangerous for the well-being of societies by and large to allow this kind of rhetoric to normalize or ignore when lies are being spread or in public sphere, people call openly for violence against anyone, because today it might be against Jews and tomorrow it will be against someone else.
You're talking about a very, very powerful, well-funded global network of NGOs. NGO Monitor was established 25 years ago after the UN Durban Conference Against Racism, where probably for the first time in a sort of a massive, explicit manner, we saw these NGO network coalescing in order to call for boycotts, even violence against Israel, against the Jewish state at the NGO forum of the UN's World Conference at Durban. Have there been successes? I mean, can an organization like NGO Monitor or People Who Care, can they fight back? Is it possible with facts, with data, to move the needle to, and what does success look like in countering this war, whether on the sort of the political diplomatic level or the funding on the ground level or in the strategic communications, public diplomacy level? Is it possible to achieve success, and what does success look like?
It's actually a good question, Asher, because most of the time everyone deals with diagnosing the problem. And I think so much has been said about it. And especially after October the 7th, we all feel it wherever we are in the world, right? And I do believe that more attention should be paid collectively to what can we do. And this is why for me, what we do at NGO Monitor is crucial, because at the end of the day, in this era of half-truths and distorted truths and oftentimes lies that are spread against the Jewish people and the state of Israel, and in general, right, which is being amplified by the fact that anyone is a communications guru today because you have social media. The only thing that we have, the only weapon that we have, is facts and figures. And that is something, the only thing that no one can dispute. That's sort of what we do. We are a research institute, and we document systematical distortions of human rights and humanitarian causes by these NGOs. And at the same time, we follow the money and display publicly information of who is behind these organizations and who funds them. We feel that this is a service to the broader public, and that people, thanks to our research, and have a more informed conversation about these issues. And what we do with these reports is that we proactively share them with the decision makers, elected officials, governmental officials, journalists, and any other interested party. So what does a success look like for us? And I would split it in three. Number one is we would alert governments around the world, and we do that on a regular basis, about the cases where taxpayers' money is being funneled through funding some of these groups to organizations that promote anti-Semitism or ties to terror organizations. Or, we have seen this after October the 7th, where Palestinian groups deny that sex crimes ever happened October the 7th. And because we believe that this is also violating what these governments want to do in their programs. So a success in that context would be governments freezing funds or cutting funds to some of these groups. And this is happening more and more. It's important to say here that, after October the 7th, almost all European governments froze funding to Palestinian organizations and opened investigations. Some did a better job at investigating than others. We were instrumental because all of a sudden no one else had such big databases based, by the way, solely on open source information. So something that people can verify independently by themselves. And we had multiple cases where the EU stopped a lot of their funding, but not only. And this leads me into what would be the second type of success for us. And that is policy changes. The funding is only important if it comes with a revision of how we even arrived at a situation that a government does not notice that they are funding a group that has terror affiliation. So if a government stops funding to one group but doesn't revise their eligibility criteria, how they choose an organization, how they vet them, what kind of reports and reporting they request from them, but also accountability. What kind of reporting does the government give to the parliament, and whether a foreign affairs committee of a government has enough information to have an informative conversation when the government comes to report, right? It's a whole chain of... And finally, and this is maybe the most important thing to my mind, let's say that a government is caught in a situation that, you know, is funding somebody something problematic, what happens then? If there's no pre-described sanctions mechanism, then none of this matters. So a much more important success for us is when we motivate any one government to revise any one of the stages in this vetting mechanism. And it is important to say that more and more governments have been doing this as well. For example, the European Parliament, the European government, after October the 7th, have included, they have added what they call an anti-incitement clause in their contracts with Palestinian NGOs only. That teaches us two things. Number one, they were not checking before for incitement. And number two, once they checked, they understood the magnitude of the problem, so much so that they felt compelled to add an additional clause addressing this. Just last month, the European Parliament's annual budgetary resolution quoted NGO Monitor's report and called for better vetting on this issue. Political and policy recommendations that we would like to see in every country around the world. There's no government that has bulletproof mechanisms, which is okay. You cannot expect, it's not a logical explanation or realistic one of any one government to at any given moment be able to give you a full rundown of what every NGO that they're engaged with or partnering with in the world is doing. However, they should have mechanisms that if there is someone alerting them to a problem, that they know how to respond to it with accountability and responsibility. And that is definitely not the case. And then the last, the third way in which we sort of, you know, what we would call a success is trying to, by and large, change a discourse around these groups. And this is the toughest one to measure. And the best way I can, give this some sort of metrics is that if 25 years ago, when Gerald created the organization, everyone sort of told him, why bother? Who cares about these groups? Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Al-Haq, you know, none of them really matter. Today, everyone knows that these reports of these groups matter, that the damage that they can cause is tremendous, that the funding to these groups is a huge issue. We know, now everyone knows that when the UN launches an emergency appeal for Gaza in the last quarter of 2023, which usher is the 3 months following October the 7th. So everyone's talking about the gravest humanitarian crisis, you know, hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes and so on inside of Gaza. The IDF is already in the middle of its military operation. The UN emergency appeal asks for $1.6 billion in funding, and they state three objectives that they would like to address. The third one is political advocacy. Let that linger with you for a second. Not tents, not medication, not, you know, vaccines, not diapers or baby formulas, political advocacy projects. When you hear that word, everyone listening to this podcast should only understand apartheid, genocide, medical malpractice, starvation campaign against us, as well as Christoph's op-ed. And that sort of, you know, rounds it up at how important that is and puts sort of a number on this. There's no accurate figures in terms of how much of the governmental aid money goes to NGOs, because this whole industry is extremely intransparent. But I can tell you that I have seen internal documents by the German government that put this figure for Germany. And again, Germany is the second largest donor. So in percentages, this is probably more or less accurate for any government, right? That anywhere between 10% and 1/4 of aid money goes to political advocacy projects that are done through or by NGOs. These are the numbers. It's huge. It's an industry. And a big part of that machinery has one goal, and that is to vilify the Jewish state and the mere legitimacy that we have won. It has nothing to do with which government is in power, what is the coalition. None of these numbers changed, you know, under Bennett-Lapid government or some other there's absolutely no change depending on which government is in place.
You know, you said you think that now everybody understands this challenge. I think you're absolutely right that thanks to the work of NGO Monitor, of Gerald Steinberg, I remember in 2004 when NGO Monitor was still a teeny organization in the basement of another policy center and actually interned at NGO Monitor that summer. And it's incredible to see how the organization has grown. I do think that there's still a lot, and I'm sure you would agree, there's still a lot of work to be done because, as you said, this is not just a nuisance or a PR challenge. This is a second hand or second arm or second front. I don't know what to say, eighth front to the ninth front. I can't count anymore. But it is a real front in the very battle for Israel's continued existence and international standing, international reputation, and impacts Israel's security in very, very real and concrete ways. Olga, it's been great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for the work that you've done as Vice President of NGO Monitor, now in your new role as incoming President of NGO Monitor. And thank you, it's fantastic to have you at the Miskov Institute for National Security. And I think it's very, very fitting because, as we've said, this is a core component and this battle is a core component of Israel's national security.
Absolutely. And I was just about to end with that. That is probably the most important thing to say. This is a matter of national security, and that cannot and must not be undermined because it is an extremely, unfortunately, effective tool against us, one that we struggle in fighting much more than on a physical battlefield. And Asher, I want to thank you for inviting me on your show and for giving the time for me to share more details about what it is that we do.
Thank you for listening. Please make sure to follow the Miskov Institute at www.miskovins.org and on all social media platforms, the Miskov Institute. Again, you can send your comments, questions, suggestions to Mideast Horizons Podcast at gmail.com. And we look forward to seeing you next time.